Welcome to the Human Centered Leadership Podcast with me, your host, Colm Hay. I have worked in the leadership space for 3 decades, and now I work with organizations and leaders to develop powerful cultures of high value and performance that is built all around their people. We will interview leaders from around the world and at the very top end of their game to explore what emotional intelligence in practice actually looks like and the benefits that it could bring to any team. This is a movement to transform the way that we see leadership and to create powerful cultures where people feel seen, heard, valued and appreciated, and consequently perform to the very best. Why don't you join the movement and subscribe to our podcast? And don't forget to click on notifications to stay up to date with all new content.
Welcome to another episode where I get to speak to incredible leaders from around the globe.
Today's conversation is probably going to be one of the most inspiring conversations we've had on this show for a long, long time. Because today I've got a very special guest. I've got with me Trudy McCaffrey. Now, some of you might be scratching your head and thinking, I might have heard that name recently. Trudy was, I think, one of the pioneers of women's football, which has only just been celebrated on a BBC programme. Was it BBC programme, Trudy, the film?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
COPA 71. If you haven't watched it, genuinely, it is a very inspiring programme, I watched it, then I had to read up around it. Because the facts that were coming out, I mean, stuff that I've never really even heard of. And we're going to sort of explore your journey in women's football. And we're talking back to like the 60s and the 70s here. And, you know, most of us will be forgiven to think that women's football is something fairly new, right? So we've had the Lionesses, we've had incredible success over the last 4 or 5 years. I've watched most of the matches that the Lionesses have been involved in, whether it's the European Cup or the World Cup. And I have to say my heart was full because I was so inspired by these young ladies and the stuff that they were doing. And also the stuff that they've done after football as well, the commentating, you know, going on as celebrities. And every single time I just found them carrying themselves with such passion and such thoughtfulness in terms of the understanding the impact that they're having on other people. So they really are behaving like role models. But it goes way, way back, doesn't it? I had no idea, Trudy, that women's football was actually huge during the World War One.
It was massive. It's been massive for years and years, on and off, but really at the dictates of the FA. You know, the FA sort of took it out of its box when it suited them to and then made it go firmly back in and shut the lid on it when it didn't. So, you know, there was plenty of women's football about during the First World War because obviously a lot of the men were off fighting. Yeah. So, women basically filled the gap in many of the other ways that they did, you know, working in factories and things like that. So they became the workforce and they became the sporting heroes of the time as well. And the crowds were absolutely massive, you know, in the same way that they are today. So, yeah, I mean, ladies football has been on the go for a lot longer than people actually realise.
Yeah.
As I say, sometimes it's been there because the FA have wanted it to be there and allowed it. And then at other times it's been, well, you know, the men are home now. Let's shut it all back down again. Thank you very much, but we don't want it anymore.
And you're so right, you know, as you've been talking there, I've just realised, of course, women were plugging the gap that men left behind because they'd gone to fight on the front. And the factories are full of women. Most of the labouring that was ordinarily done by men was done by women. So why should they not be playing football? And actually, they were getting some really big crowds. You know, women's football was not just being played. It was actually very popular as well, wasn't it? And they were attracting some large crowds.
Yeah, it was absolutely massive. If you look at the photographs from the time, the stands were absolutely heaving with people. You know, you could sort of probably compare it with the kind of cup final of the day where people squashed right the way up to the lines on the pitch. There were so many people there. The enthusiasm was there, the skill was there, and people were genuinely interested in it all. And a lot of the women were very, very good. But as I say, it was only for a short period of time until the men came back. And then it all seemed to disappear again. And that really seems to have been the journey all the way through, which is a shame because, you know, when I talk to people about it now, the theme that keeps coming through is that we could have been where the Lionesses are now, but many, many, many years ago.
That's how I've read it as well, Trudy.
Yeah. And certainly after Mexico 71, everybody could see what a commercial success it had been. It was absolutely massive. It was the biggest party in the world.
Having read what I've read now, it seems to me that was like the precipice. It was like they were right on the edge of something huge, weren't they, women's
yeah.
football? But in order for you to get to 71, things happened fairly quickly over like a space of 4 or 5 years. And, you know, Women's Football Association was being formed, and didn't FIFA give permission for WFA to be formed? And then there was a chap called Harry Batt who came along. And so in essence, we had this like parallel going on. So can you just talk, I mean, you were around then. What was going on then? What, just talk me through what the WFA was doing and what Harry Batt was doing.
Yeah, it's actually quite difficult for the younger element of the team that went out to Mexico in 71, because we were only, as I say, youngster schoolgirls at the time. Mm. I mean, for me, I went to Mexico, but prior to that, I'd played in Sicily and Italy as well. At age 15 and 16, we didn't really understand the politics. We didn't really know about the politics, because really all we wanted to do was
play football, right?
We didn't yeah. care about what else was going on. But of course, there was this massive power play going on behind the scenes, with Harry wanting to make it a big thing, because people say, oh, Harry Batt, yeah, but he was just a bus driver. Okay, if you want to put it that way, he was a bus driver who could speak 5 languages fluently and had fought in the Civil War, the Spanish Civil War, and knew an awful lot about Europe, had the contacts, had the networks, and really knew how to get things done. So, you know, he wasn't one of these people who let himself drown in bureaucracy. If he saw an idea that he was convinced by, he'd go after it and he'd make it work. He'd bring people together. He'd get them all fired up, you know, and all passionate about the things that he was talking about. And yeah. that's what he could see in terms of where women's football could be. I mean, he was the person who attracted, certainly for Sicily and Italy, Martini Rossi, the drinks people, sponsored us to play at that tournament. And that's the kind of league that he was sort of operating in. And I think that's what annoyed the FA and the WFA. And, you know, they were tootling around on the sidelines, yeah. coming up with rules and regulations, because, of course, when you start anything up, there's got to be a raft of rules and regulations, which slows everything down.
There's a big leadership lesson here for me. And, you know, I've worked at the senior level in the police service. You were a prison governor. And, you know, people might be looking at this and, what, prison governor? Yeah, I mean, you've been in the prison service a long time. You've headed up a lot of different prisons in the prison service. And so, of course, we've both experienced leadership. But this example that you're giving here, Trudy, for me is a really powerful leadership
Massive.
Example. And it, yeah. you see a lot of organizations now, don't you, that are steeped in bureaucracy, that want to regulate when perhaps regulation is not the number one priority that should be. They want to create the atmosphere, the environment, but actually then you'll see these leaders that want to disrupt, and they yep. want to get something done, and they're driven by passion, and they just get, they cut through corners and they cut through the noise and get things done. And it seems to me that this relationship, this parallel thing that was going on with the WFA on one side and Harry Batt on the other side, you saw this stark difference between the two.
Yeah.
WFA was all about, you know, we want to work within these guidelines, these regulations, this way of being, and we want to do it nice and slowly. Whereas Harry Batt was, no, why do we need to do this slowly? We need to get ourselves onto a world stage. So he created the first England women's football team. Is that right?
Pretty much. I mean, he scoured the country to find his players. But of course, again, the older ones were aware, well, some of the older ones were aware, that if they played abroad, they'd be banned when they came home. So
ah, right.
We didn't, some of us didn't actually get that again, because once again, the politics were just not what we were about. We just wanted to play. So we didn't realise that that was happening. So, yeah, although he scoured the country for players, some of the players who could have gone didn't. Because, and again, when you think back to the times of their time, in the 70s, they were holding down jobs as typists and, you know, maybe teachers and things like that. And were told, quite frankly, well, if you go and do that, there won't be a job here for when you get back. So, you know, your choice sort of thing. Well, it's no choice at all, really, is it? So again, some of them realised that they may be banned when they came back, which would wreck any idea that they'd got of a career for the future.
And that message probably came from the WFA, didn't it, I guess, because there was this falling out between Harry Batt and the WFA, and they said that he'd created this England team, but it wasn't the official England team, albeit there was no official England team because the WFA hadn't created, at that time, an official England team.
Yeah.
So they were really upset about him doing that. And so then there was this threat that if you do get involved with this fake England team going to Mexico, that you will be banned from playing in other clubs as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, and Harry Batt himself was banned for life when we came back from Mexico. It wasn't just a little thing. He was actually banned for life, which pretty much destroyed him because, you know, pushing the idea of women's football on was his passion. The thing is that he'd seen more of it operating at those levels in Europe than we were used to seeing in England. There was nothing comparable in England at all. But to see it on the stage, I mean, when we went to Sicily, when we played in Italy, we played in the Juventus Stadium. We played in big stadiums in front of big crowds. And he knew what these possibilities were and more importantly, how he could exploit them.
What I read into the film and what I've read subsequently is that UK was far behind a lot of other countries in the way that we saw and perceived and supported women's football. Because, of course, let me just talk. I want to get into your experience of Mexico, because when I was reading some of the numbers and the descriptions, I was just like, wow, what that must have felt like. I mean, you played against Argentina. Now, every time England plays against Argentina, obviously it's a big thing, isn't it? But I didn't realise that you were playing against Argentina way back in 1970, and it's a big thing. And it's quite a tough match, wasn't it? It's quite a physical match. How did that feel? And you were in front of something like 25,000 people, which is a small number, really, given the numbers.
Yeah, but, you know, you take it back a stage further. We played in the qualifiers in Italy and in Sicily. So when you think back to the 1970 Men's World Cup, and England were out, weren't they, and lost to Germany. And just to sort of put the contrast in here, we beat the German girls team 5-1.
Wow.
So, you know, we didn't just arrive in Mexico having come from nowhere. We'd actually, you know, won games to get there, worked our way through to get there.
Yeah, you qualified.
Yeah, and then on to Mexico itself. Argentina was our first match. And believe it or not, the second match was the day after. We had no rest in between.
Yeah, yes, I heard this. It was something like, was it 18 hours later you were then having to
back
play Mexico?
Back on the pitch again.
Oh, crazy.
Back on the pitch again.
And you were all battered and bruised because it was a very physical match with Argentina
It was very, very physical match, yeah. And we were hard. We were a hard team in our own right in the UK. You know, we played fast, we played hard. We were known for it. We won with usually quite significant goal differences. But we hadn't had that exposure on the world stage.
Yes.
And really, you know, because of how far behind England was at that time, there wasn't really any way of getting that kind of experience other than with teams that were similar to yourself. So, you know, playing abroad and coming up against teams like Argentina, to whom winning was all that mattered. And yes, we wanted to win. Of course we did. That's why we'd gone over there. But you're talking about girls here who were quite prepared to run over you rather than run around you. You know, they wanted to win at all costs and didn't really mind how they did it. So, yeah, there were lots and lots of injuries and cuts and bruises and things like that.
This also tells me of something else. And you know, again, there's a leadership lesson in that for me is, yes, you were incredible players. You had done really well. You'd gone through the qualifiers and things like that. But it's almost like when you get onto that world stage, is there a mental sort of challenge for you there in terms of the stepping up from playing in maybe UK or playing in Europe? And then stepping up, you're now in the Aztec Stadium. You are 90,000 people there. You're playing against South American teams, the two teams that you played against. And we know that they're incredibly passionate about football and they want to win at all costs. How is that playing on the mental sort of solidity of the team, because some of your players were like 14 years old.
Yeah, and of course the other thing is that a lot of the other teams had been playing together for an awful lot longer than we had. We're used to that. We're used to playing on that stage, and they were grown women, not teenagers. So you know, you were talking about maybe apples and pears in a lot of ways, but yeah. Certainly mentally after the first match. I wouldn't say that we weren't prepared, because having played in Italy and Sicily in the way that we had, we'd faced some of the teams before, so we knew what we were up against. But, you know, you're attempting to make a step up from what is a sort of pretty impossible position. If you think about playing on a Sunday afternoon on a pitch where perhaps you may have had dog walkers and cows on a couple of hours before, you know, it was no sort of fantastic thing with lots of people watching and a beautiful manicured pitch, nothing like that. So to go from that onto the world stage and playing in the Aztec Stadium against these other teams was a massive mental step up in its own right.
Yeah,
so you had to be, you know, you had to have that certain strength of character around you to push yourself on and think, yeah, we can cope with this. We can do this. We're as good as anybody else. And, you know, a lot of that comes down to, A, your captain, Carol Wilson, and B, Harry, Bapp. Carol Wilson was a physical training instructor in the RAF, so she had a lot of oomph behind her and a lot of knowledge about physical training and getting us in shape. But she'd also got the mental side of things as well, where she could sort of get into your head. You know, you're good enough, you're fast enough, you're hard enough. So we were really fortunate to have people like that. You need that kind of leader in that kind of situation.
And tell me about Harry Bapp. What was he like? I mean, how did he imprint upon you? Because he sounds to me like an incredible visionary kind of guy and very energized.
Harry was, he was a good laugh. He was a really good singer. As I say, he was a linguist. But by the same token, he would get absolutely furious at you if he thought you weren't playing your hardest and you weren't playing your heart out. He was a good guy to have around, and always full of all the ideas that, you know, the journeys he was going to take you on because of all of these ideas that he was going to have was what inspired you.
Yeah.
You sort of listened to him and you thought, wow, I can do this. You know, he's talking about stuff that I can do here. And don't forget that probably up until that time, all you'd been told all your life in terms of playing football was no, because you're not a boy. You know, girls don't play football, girls don't do this sort of thing. And here's this guy coming along with all of these fantastic ideas, making you feel, do you know what? This is for you. You can do this.
So that messaging that we often get in our lives, don't we? The environment, depending on which environment you put yourself in, you get a different kind of messaging. If you get messaging that is all around, yes, you can do this and we're 100% behind you and you can, you know, work to your full potential, compared to you can't do this and you're not good enough and you're not allowed to do this, it makes you feel a totally different way. And the experience in England, if I remember right, was that, the WFA had said that if any of the regulated FA clubs were to allow, was it Chiltern to play
Chiltern
on their
Valley.
Field?
Yeah.
And then they would be banned or something like that. And so you couldn't play on normal football fields, basically.
No. And doesn't it feel almost like, there are, so you're not sharing them? You know, I mean, it's just pathetic.
But the irony is, this was being said by women. Because this is the WFA we're talking about, isn't it, that was saying this?
Yeah, although there were plenty of men in there as well. Although it was the WFA, I mean, obviously, most of the leaders were men. And if you look at some of the people who were making these decisions, you've got, it's typecast, it really is. You've got predominantly middle-aged white men with all the power, all the control, all the authorities, and none of the ideas.
And that must have been frustrating for a lot of people there to know that you can't afford to make this decision. You couldn't follow somebody like Harry Bapp, because if you did, that's it. You're blacklisted and you can't play for another club. But actually, what happened when you came back from Mexico was that there was this incredible opportunity, wasn't there? There was an incredible opportunity for us to actually host the World Cup in England. And Harry Bapp was approached by somebody. We'd got sponsors on the table. I think if I remember right, Harry Bapp actually approached the WFA and said, let's do this as a collaborative. And the WFA said, no, that we weren't ready yet or something.
And to say that two of the sponsors were, I believe, members of the men's England 70 team. So they obviously saw something there that they thought, you know what, this could really work. This could really go far. Mm. So, you know, you just can't get over to people how massive the whole thing was over in Mexico. And then you come home and you think you're standing on the cusp of something because of the experience that you'd had in Mexico, the speed that you played at, the experiences that you'd had, the training that you'd done, how well received you'd been in Mexico, how seriously it had all been taken. When you were coming home, you were sort of thinking, are we on the cusp of something here now? Things could really change from here because of what we've done, what we've experienced over there. This could be the start of something really big. So you've got home thinking, wow, you know, here we go. This is it. Things are really going to change this time. And to sort of contrast it, when we arrived in Mexico, it was very late, but there were loads of people in the airport, loads of flash bulbs going off, loads of press, loads of photographers.
I mean, how did that make you feel when you saw that? That must have been incredible.
Well, not really, because we were getting off the plane looking at all of this and we thought quite seriously that there was somebody famous on the plane. we had no idea.
Yes, it was. It was you guys.
Yeah, and we were sort of looking behind going, you know, who's on the plane? Who's on the plane? And then we were taken off to do interviews, you know, and everywhere we went around Mexico, we had to have a police escort. We had press embedded in the hotel with us all the time. Even when we trained in the early hours of the morning, you'd probably have 500 or 600 people there watching you. To go from that, you go home and you're literally thinking, right, this is it now. You know, we're really going to be on the way here. We got back to Heathrow Airport. There was nobody there. Nothing.
No press, no nothing?
Nothing. And it just felt completely dropped out of it all over again.
Just like 24 hours before that, you were playing in the Aztec Stadium. You had, and I know that there was no official numbers recorded, but it's between 90 and 95,000 people watching you. I mean, that must have just been such a surreal experience for all of you.
Yeah, I mean, they're the official numbers, but I mean, some people put it as high. When Denmark played in the final against Mexico, they say that the numbers were about 120,000. And certainly it's never been surpassed. Even now, those numbers haven't been surpassed. So it was massive. It was absolutely huge.
So on a globe, here we go. I mean, you know, we see this in organisations as well. But if you look at the outside world, you can see that the outside world seems to embrace something that's new, something innovative, something exciting.
Yep.
And then you come back into either your own country or your own organisation and you think, it's just flat because nobody's interested in this at all. Or nobody's got the leadership courage to make this happen. And I think that's what it was. It was a leadership courage, because the opportunity was there. The opportunity was there to hold a World Cup in the United Kingdom, in England, just like a couple of years later, and we missed the boat out on that because we didn't have the leadership courage to make it happen.
Yeah, and so rather than embrace Harry and his thinking and his vision and saying, do you know what, maybe we should get alongside of this because this is inspiring stuff. And well, all right, it's a bit thinking outside of the box. Mm. It's a little bit more radical than we're used to. It's a bit scary.
Change is scary, right?
But there's already been an example of how well it's worked. So in terms of the risk, you know, there was not really a risk as such. In fact, when we came back from Mexico, I did a little bit of after-dinner speaking to things like the Rotary Clubs and stuff like that, where I was billed as an England football player. So it was a bit of a shock to people when I walked in because they were expecting somebody like Bobby Moore or whatever, you know. But once I got talking, without exception, all of the guys at those events were absolutely intrigued, fascinated, but probably more importantly, at a loss to understand why those commercial possibilities hadn't been exploited. They couldn't understand why somebody in the FA hadn't got up, grabbed it and really run with it.
So let's talk about the FA, because we've been talking about the WFA, but let's talk about the FA. What was going on, do you think, now, because you've had this wealth of experience as a leader in your own right now, what do you think might have been going on in the FA there that prevented us from you know, bringing women's football to the level that it is right now? And we both know it could have been done 50 years ago. What was it that's preventing that?
I think their thinking was of its time. I think, as I described earlier, you're talking about typecast people, you know, with very fixed ideas in terms of gender and what people should or shouldn't be doing, which depends very much on their gender, and thinking that was very narrowly focused on ordinary societal norms, no more than that, really. You know, if you were a woman, you weren't supposed to go off and do this kind of thing. You were supposed to maybe go to work after school and then get married, but then not work again. And I'm talking about the 1960s and 70s here. So for them to be thinking outside of that model was probably quite difficult for them in a lot of ways. Harry wasn't like that. Harry didn't see that whole sort of societal thing. He just saw, you know, he was fairly focused on his vision and where this could be taken. So, you know, I think the other thing that might have been going on with the FA as well was maybe they felt a little bit threatened, you know, the people in power, because if you get somebody a bit radical, you know, one of those disruptors that we've talked about, if you get somebody like that who's pushing through and bringing these really novel ideas to the table and going, why not? Why not? Then people in there who've been there for a number of years are going to be feeling a little bit threatened.
I think you've hit the nail on the head. I often talk about, you know, organisations that don't seem to move forward as quickly as they could do. And I often think that that's, and I see this a lot with public sector more than private sector, because I feel they have this very defensive sort of mindset. You know, we need to defend the way things are.
It's the status
traditionally
quo.
Done.
People are
the status quo.
With
absolutely.
Status quo. It's what they know. It's what they understand. But if you don't move with the times, you can pretty soon sink your boat. Look at Wilko. It's the same kind of thing, isn't it?
Wilko's, Debenhams, Woolworths. There's so many examples out there, Blockbusters, where if you are not agile or adaptable or evolving, then you are going to get left behind, right? And we saw this actually. I don't know if you've been following the whole Royal Mail scandal thing that's been going on, and, you know, it's so sad how they were treated, the postmasters. But I remember seeing on the documentary, there was the chief exec of the Royal Mail was being interviewed by one of the MPs, and she said something that was really interesting. I thought, this is the public sector. She said, this is about protecting the reputation of the Royal Mail. And I thought, there, you've just hit the nail on the head. It's not about the people at all. It's not about doing what's right and what's wrong. It's about protecting the brand reputation. And I think this is what happens. What we do is we get so defensive around our brand reputation that we create all these tiers of bureaucracy over it that then slows down our decision-making process. And in some ways, it prevents any new and innovative ideas coming to the table. And I think that was what was going on in the 70s there.
You forget to look above the parapet and see abilities are out there, because, you know, you're so used to seeing the same thing, the same way of doing things. And I think that's where they were stuck. They were well and truly stuck. And of course, the other thing might be as well that they recognised it as maybe a commercial threat to the men's game, because you know, they're in it for the money. Let's face it, they make a lot of money from men's football. And they maybe thought, do you know what? We don't want to water down the income stream. We just don't want to do that. We've got a way of preventing it, so that's what we'll do. We're not ready for this, not by a long shot. You know, Harry was there going, yes, we are. Yes, we are. Mm-hmm. Look at Mexico. Look at what happened. Look at the numbers. Look at the money that was made. Look at the advertising. Look at the stuff that was sold on the back of the tournament. You know, it was all there, but they just couldn't see it. And I think it was about preserving that status quo and a little bit of jealousy.
And I don't think that we're all the way there now. You know, we've had an incredible success. The Lionesses are well-renowned now. They're well-respected by all concerned. But I don't think that we're all the way there yet. There's still a lot of these trepidations that are being held by people, these mindsets, these sort of echo chambers that still exist. Because women's football is nowhere near as well-sponsored and supported as men's football is, despite the fact that they've actually had better success in men's football in international competitions, right? I mean, in the World Cup, I was absolutely glued to the box. And every time England came on, I was just like, you know, this is so much more inspiring than watching men's football for me, because of the heart that they played with, the everything that a sports person should be like. They epitomised it for me. Whereas I find with men's football, it has become so commercialised now, it's so around money, that a lot of the the players, perhaps not in the national team, because you do see the passions coming out there, but you do see a lot of male footballers now that are so egocentric and revolving around that. But you don't see that in women's football.
My dad summarised it well. I mean, my dad was a football referee, which is how I got into football in the first place. So, you know, I've been playing since I was three. As soon as I could toddle about, if he was refereeing at the weekend, I used to go with him and have a kick about with different people there. So, you know, my dad had always been right behind me with all of this. And he said to me, you know, the games, you can't compare them because they're not the same. He said, you can't say that women's football is better than men and men's football is better than women's, because it is like comparing apples and pears. He said, it's the physicality of the men's game that you guys haven't got, but you're faster, you're more skillful, you're more entertaining, and you're cleaner. You bring a breath of fresh air with it because of the joy, you know, the
I
way
I think that's what
play.
It is, that joy, that joyfulness, that yeah, and it's hard to put it into words, but it's that. I think you just nailed it with that one word there, joy. And you do get a lot of joy from watching women's football. And I think that's what the Lionesses, over recent years, I think that's why they've captured so many hearts.
Yeah.
But it's such a shame, isn't it, to think that 50 years ago, we could have been there. We could have had the World Cup, but we, you know.
Well, big guns were against us. But I mean, that the beauty of it is now, when you think about the film Copa 71, the story behind that is that we had the big guns on our side this time, because it's actually backed and produced and funded by Serena and Venus Williams.
Oh, right. I did not know that.
You can't get many more bigger guns than that. So, you know, they were very much on side with this and wanting to bring the story out because of really the terrible things that had gone on and the lack of equality, you know, and just girls being told, no, you can't do it, just on the basis that, well, yeah, you might be really good at this, but you're not going to play because you're a girl.
I want to say thank you for spending time with me here. But thank you for actually pushing the boat out and going against the tide back in 71. And the years before that, when, you know, society, anybody in society would have said no to you, but you forged ahead. You did some incredible stuff there. You ended up qualifying for the World Cup. You ended up playing in Mexico, representing your country, playing in front of stadiums full of 90 to 100,000 people. I just think, you know, even now I'm thinking about it, read about it and watched the film, I was inspired. So thank you for all the people that you've inspired over these years, Trudy.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please do subscribe and click on notifications for new content. And of course, connect with me on LinkedIn. Take care. Have a great day.